what cutting aid to Central America would mean today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration wants to cut aid to three Central American nations. The president says they need to do more to stop their people from migrating north. But local laws can make that difficult.
Just like an American, you can't stop an American from traveling abroad. Well, you can't stop a Guatemalan or a Honduran from leaving their country as well.
Also, USAID is supposed to help fight the root causes of migration from the region. So who gets hurt if the aid dollars go away?
Young people, families, fleeing violence, fleeing lack of opportunity. Those are the ones that are going to be most directly impacted.
Plus, a comedian wins round one of Ukraine's presidential election. The stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good Monday to you, everybody. Glad you could make it here today. Just in case you stepped away from the news over the weekend, President Trump is threatening to close the U.S. southern border this week.
We'll keep it closed for a long time. I'm not playing games.
There was also this.
I've ended payments to Guatemala, to Honduras, and to El Salvador. Oh, no money goes there anymore. We were giving them $500 million. We were giving them tremendous aid. We stopped payment to Honduras, to Guatemala, and to El Salvador. We were paying them tremendous amounts of money, and we're not paying them anymore because they haven't done a thing for us.
A decision to cut off aid to three Central American countries. It's punishment, the White House says, for not stopping their citizens from leaving those countries and coming to the U.S. Shannon O'Neill's with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. How much aid did Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador get last year, Shannon?
So last year, they were designated to get somewhere in the range of $530 million. That is a decline from a couple of years ago when it was almost three-quarters of $1 billion, $750 million. We have seen the Trump administration each year ask for less money for this aid to the Central American nations, though we have seen a bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress to put money back there. So there is a back and forth between the administration and the Congress to support these countries that we've seen for the last couple of years, culminating in the decision of Trump and the administration this last week.
So that's over $500 million. Where does that money go?
That money is split fairly evenly between the three Central American nations, between Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And it goes to all kinds of programs to address the root causes of migration from these countries. It goes to programs to counter drug trafficking. It goes to programs to strengthen the police, to bring safety to the streets. It goes to all sorts of small programs to help economic growth, to help seed microfinance for entrepreneurs, for farmers. So it's a combination of all sorts of programs to really support Guatemala and Honduran, El Salvadoran society and make it better for the people so that they can stay there and don't think about leaving their countries and heading to the United States.
I mean, it sounds like where this money is headed is pretty comprehensive. What's been the impact of that aid? Because we're talking $530 million, and that's actually a drop. I don't know. Is it working?
Well, this is a lot less than we spend in many other places. And today we spend over $20 billion on law enforcement at the border. So $20 billion at the border to stop these individuals coming up versus $500 million back in their country to try to make the situation better so that they don't leave in the first place. So it's a small amount overall that we're spending. But I do think it is having effects on the ground. It is keeping hundreds, thousands of people still there because it gives them an opportunity and hope in the places that they are.
How do we know that it is keeping all these people on the ground?
So when the U.S. government spends millions of dollars on foreign assistance or on other types of programs, they often do evaluations. They look to see what happens to the people that get involved in these programs. They look to see what happens to the crops that they support. We also see a lot of these nonprofit organizations, much of this money does not go to the governments of El Salvador, Honduras, or Guatemala. It goes to NGOs. It goes to nonprofits. It goes to community organizations, not to the governments. And those organizations report back what happens. They look at the communities that they're serving and the movement of people. So we do have some evidence that when these funds are invested at a local level, fewer people leave the communities where these funds go in, where these programs are started up, than, say, the neighborhood next door that doesn't receive these types of investments.
So are you saying that if Trump really wants to punish these governments in the Northern Triangle, he won't be successful because so much of this money does not actually go to governments, it goes to smaller NGOs?
But he won't be taking money from the governments as much. He'll be taking more money from smaller NGOs. What these countries will have to deal with is an increased economic desperation, perhaps increasing level of violence, because you won't have some of the programs that were helping tamper down these effects in society.
The president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, met with the White House National Security Advisor John Bolton last week. And Hernandez said Honduras has a solid bilateral relationship with the U.S. What have you heard from the Northern Triangle countries? Is this news of aid getting cut off from Washington a shock to them?
This is a great shock because just last week, these governments signed a cooperation agreement, a security cooperation agreement with the Department of Homeland Security. So just as they're signing agreements to deepen the security ties between the United States and these nations, the president decides to cut off all aid to these governments. And so far, their reaction has been quite muted.
It has been announced now, but it is unclear if the spigot of aid has actually immediately been turned off. I know Trump announced something like this last October. What happened then when he threatened to cut off U.S. aid? Did he actually follow through?
So back last October, he didn't follow through. He threatened on Twitter and talked about it, but never followed through. And there is a challenge here in that money that is both legislated by Congress, but also appropriated by Congress. Congress has approved the spending, and in between the balance of powers in the United States, the executive branch needs to go spend that money. Now, Trump may have some leeway in how that money has spent, but he does need to go forward, at least with the money that's already been appropriated, and make some sort of effort to spend it in these countries.
So it is possible, you're saying, that he may be saying, we're going to cut off this money, but it might not actually happen.
It's not the first time we've seen a tweet go out and set policy that never actually becomes a reality.
You've probably also seen this thing that Trump has been saying, that Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador take their criminals, put them into caravans, and then send them to the U.S.
In many cases, they put their worst people in the caravan. They're not going to put their best in. They get rid of their problems, and they march up here.
We don't really know where that idea comes from. It sounds conspiratorial. Do you know where that story comes from?
That sounds very conspiratorial to me. And in fact, most of these caravans have nothing to do with the governments. These are individuals. These are families. These are communities making decisions to leave their country for the circumstances of their life, for the challenges they face. But the governments of these countries are not pushing their individuals to leave. And their citizenship laws say that they can't stop these people from leaving. Just like an American, you can't stop an American from traveling abroad. Well, you can't stop a Guatemalan or a Honduran from leaving their country as well. And so that is the dilemma that these governments face. They're not pushing their citizens out actively. They're not forming these caravans. These are individual decisions made privately by citizens of these countries.
Shannon O'Neill with the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Right now, USAID to Central America is distributed to programs run by many different organizations. Catholic Relief Services is one of them. It runs a variety of programs that are supposed to help prevent migration from the region, focusing on things like job training, skill sharing, and mental health resources. Kay Andrade works with one program in El Salvador funded by USAID dollars. It's called Segundas Oportunidades, which means second chances. It works with people within El Salvador's prison system.
Prisons in El Salvador are incredibly overcrowded. There's at least 300 to 400% overcrowding in prisons. There's currently 54,000 people in prison in El Salvador right now, in a system that can handle less than a third of that.
That has been since the Segunda Oportunidades program started. What did prison rehab look like in El Salvador prior to this program?
I would say it was non-existent, absolutely non-existent. There's been a lot of attitude in the country, even in the Central America region, that if you've committed a crime, in this case, a lot of people have only been arrested for a crime, that you should be punished and severely punished. So then people are just forgotten about.
The Catholic Relief Services program means second chances. Tell me about the people you work with most typically, and what have your programs done for them?
So the last 2 years, our programs have been working with inmates as well as with prison authorities and guards, and helping them understand that there are other options for them. And that is helping them build their resilience and creating a new identity for themselves.
Kay, I guess what I really want to know is what progress have you seen since this program has been around, and what does progress look like for you?
Let me tell you the story of one woman, an inmate. A fight broke out in her cell block, and she was being egged on to join the fight and get involved in the brawl. And she was using the tools that we gave her of how to look at what was in her control and not in her control, her thoughts, feelings, and actions. And she decided right then and there, I don't need this. She was called all sorts of names. But in the end, when the fight was broken up, she was not taken off in handcuffs to solitary confinement. So she was able to make that change. So it's a pretty powerful step that we're seeing in individual lives and how they're being able to change others.
Yeah, I mean, that's remarkable. And it seems kind of an exceptional example, since what you're proposing would then get spread by word of mouth inside the facility, inside the prison. What would happen, Kay, to all of the work you've just described with the budget cuts the U.S. has said it's going to do?
So when I heard about this weekend, my first thought went to our Second Chances program. We have a lot of money from the U.S. government for programming throughout Central America in youth work, but then in particular with this programming. We're still trying to figure out, like so many other organizations, of what the implications could be or what funding might be impacted, funding that's already been approved and allocated or not. But there are virtually no organizations that are allowed into the prisons and have built the trust in working with prison authorities to do this. And if we can't work on making these kind of changes, and if that is cut off, I'm just very concerned about, the work that has been forged over the last 2 years in building trust with the Salvadoran prison authorities and being able to be there for them, to support them in building out this rehabilitation program.
Will all the aspects of Segunda Oportunidades programming still be able to function? Are there other funders that you can rely on if U.S. government support disappears?
CRS has been using some of our own funding to be able to supplement what the U.S. government is supporting us on. But it's not enough, and we have no other funding sources right now for that particular project.
Who do you think will be impacted the most by these cuts?
The Central American people, the very young people, families that are fleeing violence, fleeing lack of opportunity, those are the ones that are going to be most directly impacted. I think rather than stemming migration, this will only lead to more migration.
Kay Andrade is a youth workforce development advisor for Latin America in El Salvador with Catholic Relief Services. Thanks very much, Kay.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A comedian with no political experience has won the first round of presidential elections in Ukraine. Vladimir Zelensky will now face the second-place finisher, incumbent Ukrainian president Petro Poroshenko. The runoff is in a few weeks. Reporter Veronika Melkozirova is in Kiev, Ukraine. I asked her about the inevitable comparison that some people have made between Zelensky, the comedian candidate, and former reality TV star Donald Trump.
It's more what the analysts in the West do. Our political analysts compare him to Ronald Reagan.
Why is that?
Mostly because maybe Zelensky is not so, how to describe Trump, not to offend your president. It's Zelensky has more positive image than Trump. He's less notorious. He's like more than a funny guy, talented actor.
So what does it take to become president of Ukraine?
You need to get a financial support of one of our top oligarchs. And also you need to get the media support, and all the major TV channels in Ukraine, they belong to the oligarchs. That is why a rumor has it that without a support of an oligarch or maybe several oligarchs, it is almost impossible to be elected president in Ukraine.
Would Ukrainians say that's fair, that's democratic, if you need that rich oligarch support and media support?
No, it's not democratic, but we don't have another option. People are still voting, and all the electoral watchdogs, they say our elections were fair and democratic, but still people do not read the programs of the candidates. They just trying to orient of whom to vote for by watching oligarchs TV stations, by maybe, I don't know, maybe taking some money for voting, because some of the candidates were caught trying to buy voters for about $37.
Veronica, what's at stake for this election, for Russia and for countries in the West?
The stakes are huge. After these elections, Ukraine might either turn back to Russia or keep its path to the West. While Poroshenko positions himself as the only person who can save Ukraine from Russia, Zelensky says that he's ready to negotiate with Russia. And Russian officials, they already said that they are ready to negotiate with anyone but Poroshenko. If Poroshenko would be reelected, they say they won't consider this election to be legitimate and there will be nothing to talk with Ukraine.
Are Ukrainians ready for some negotiation with Russia under Zelensky? I mean, how do you personally feel about that?
I personally think that it depends from the narrative of the negotiations, because Russia is trying to dictate. If Ukraine will step back and let Russia to have Crimea, for example, or to have the parts of Donbass it occupied in 2014, this will mean that we will slowly return back under the Russian influence. And this will mean that we won't have the right for democratic elections, or maybe democratic looking like elections, because unlike other countries of the post-Soviet bloc, Ukraine still has this option to choose its leader. We are all very proud of it. And if we will return to Russia, we will become like a satellite, like Belarus or Kazakhstan, and we don't want that.
Journalist Veronica Melko-Zirova in Kiev, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Israel has the saltiest body of water in the world. Now it has the longest salt cave. Researchers near the Dead Sea say they've mapped 6 miles of the Malham Cave there. Amos Frumpkin is a geologist at Hebrew University. Tell us what it feels like to be inside the salty chambers of this cave.
Well, they are quite beautiful. Sometimes transparent, sometimes very white. It's kind of very, very exciting.
Can you actually taste the salt when you enter the cave?
Yes, you can. You can easily. If it is a stalactite or stalagmite, it is pure salt, like in the kitchen. Mm. And if it is just the wall of the cave, it's less pure.
I've seen some of the pictures. It's really, I mean, it is gorgeous. I mean, it looks like almost diamonds hanging from the ceiling and the walls. Professor Frumpkin is somebody who studied this cave for a long time. Were you surprised to realize how big it is?
Yes, I did not know that it is so long. We thought that it is a few kilometers long, more than 6, but we didn't know that it is really more than 10 kilometers long. But this depends on the enthusiasm of the cavers who survey it. Like if they manage to crawl into the most tight places, and if they hang with the ropes in shafts and make kind of pendulum to the side passages, high levels of the cave, then they are able to map all the passages, even those which are less easy to reach.
I know geologists see a lot of history inside rock and earth. What did you learn about history from what you've seen in this cave?
The cave is acting like a time capsule, generally for many things. In this case, it's much about climate history of this place and the country, because the salt is so easily dissolved. And in addition, we had a lot of pieces of wood being swept into the cave from the surface of the mountain. And these allowed us to date the cave passages by radiocarbon. So we have exact climatic history of the region for the last 8,000 years.
I don't know if you're aware, but some people say there are health benefits to breathing the air of natural or man-made salt caves. You've been in the salt cave a number of times. What do you make of this?
I agree. After I visit the cave, I feel better. If I came with some kind of, let's say, high temperature or so, I feel better when I come out. I do believe it works.
Do you think the Malam cave is going to have to be protected now that it's been publicized?
Yes, I think so. It should be protected, because otherwise we shall not have such beautiful things anywhere in the world if it's not protected. We don't have such features in most other places. Like in North America, I believe there is not a single salt cave.
Have you ever been into a cave in North America that comes even close to kind of how spectacular the Malam cave is?
Oh, yes. The most spectacular cave in the world, perhaps, in North America. That's La Chaguilla cave. But it is in limestone. It's not in salt.
And where is that cave?
This cave is in New Mexico, but it's closed to the public. It's difficult to visit it.
All the beautiful things are close to the public.
Yes, most of them.
Mm-hmm. Amos Frumkin, geologist at Hebrew University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. Looking at satellite photos of North Korean weapons sites is not an exact science. An image might seem to show preparations for a missile launch.
But it could also be four trucks really closely, you know, caravaned together. So with this level of resolution, we just can't be certain.
Peering into North Korea from above, that's still ahead here on The World. U.S. Army General Robert Abrams was on Capitol Hill a few days ago. He's a commander of U.S. and allied forces in Korea. And listen to his answer to the following question. Texas Congressman Mac Thornberry wanted to know if the North Koreans are making progress on denuclearization.
We know they have not tested, but in the production of nuclear weapons and material and missiles, has there been a change?
Sir, their activity that we've observed is inconsistent with denuclearization.
Inconsistent with denuclearization. In other words, the North is not showing signs that it's willing to give up its nuclear weapons. How does the top brass of the Pentagon know that? Satellite imagery, for one, photos taken from far above North Korean weapon sites. Some of these pictures are actually for sale to the public. The World's Matthew Bell went to visit one group in Washington that uses satellite imagery to figure out what's happening inside North Korea.
38 North runs a website about North Korean-related security issues. The number 38 refers to the 38th parallel on the map that cuts across the middle of the Korean Peninsula. Also known as the DMZ, Demilitarized Zone, it's what divides North Korea from South Korea. Jenny Town is managing editor of 38 North. Her interest in the country goes back to her college days in the mid-1990s.
I spent a year in South Korea studying at the Ewha Women's University in Seoul. I remember there were reports coming out in the news that there was this famine starting in North Korea, and no one in South Korea believed it.
People in the South grew up thinking of the North Koreans as their enemies, so they immediately assumed the news about a famine was fake, Town says, part of a scheme to extract something from the outside world. That was troubling to her, and it sparked a long-term quest to learn more about North Korea. Years later, Town teamed up with a former Clinton administration official to start 38 North. The problem with North Korea, she says, is that there's so much interest, but not a lot of reliable information about the place. Eventually, analyzing satellite images of the country's military sites became a central part of their work.
We use all commercial satellite imagery. The major companies we buy from the high-resolution imagery is Digital Globe and Airbus. Digital Globe is an American company. Airbus is a French company. We'll use Google Earth sometimes for kind of a historical reference point.
But the images from Google Earth aren't updated frequently enough, and they're not high resolution enough to figure out what's happening on the ground. Every morning, Town's team at 38 North looks over satellite pictures of North Korean missile and nuclear sites for signs of activity. They have former military and intelligence analysts working with them, people who know all about the North's weapons systems. The U.S. government is thought to have much more detailed images of North Korea, but the commercial ones show about 18 inches per pixel.
Right now, we're looking at an image where it looks like it could be military vehicles. It looks like it could be a TEL, a transporter erector launcher that you transport like a missile system on. But it could also be four trucks really closely, you know, caravaned together. So with this level of resolution, we just can't be certain. And so we always have at least two or three analysts look at it, weigh in on it.
Town says this is not an exact science. Seeing that some trucks have moved around a missile site, for example, might indicate that the North Koreans are getting ready to launch an actual missile. Or they might simply be trying to send a signal to whoever is watching. Joel Witt says this is important to keep in mind. He's the Clinton administration official who founded 38 North. He's met with North Korean diplomats many times over the years, and they've told him that they also follow the site's reporting.
They know when these satellites fly over these installations, so they can time activities in terms of knowing that people will be taking pictures of them, and they can use that in various ways to send signals, to confuse people. So, you know, I think they've integrated it into their thinking.
Even knowing that isn't enough. Satellite imagery might be useful, but it almost never paints a complete picture of what's really happening. Bob Carlin has spent a lifetime paying attention to North Korea. He's a former intelligence officer at the State Department and CIA analyst. He says in an isolated country like North Korea, you still need to have context.
When the first time I went to North Korea, I had been following North Korea for a couple of decades, I guess, and I knew the place from the satellite imagery. That I always viewed it from however thousands of feet above the Earth. So when I first got there and I was on the ground, it's completely different. It's a three-dimensional human society, and you don't get that feeling from the air. You don't understand the country.
Analysts are watching closely now after the second Trump-Kim summit ended in failure. When movement was detected by satellite photos at one North Korean launch site a few weeks ago, experts disagreed about what it meant. A space launch, perhaps? A missile test? So far, nothing has been launched from that site. If it does happen, a Trump administration official said, it would be, quote, inconsistent with the commitments the North Koreans have made. For the World, Matthew Bell, Washington.
We were talking earlier on the show about election results from the weekend's vote in Ukraine, but it wasn't the only country holding elections this past weekend. There were also local elections in Turkey, and the results seem to have taken the country's president by surprise. Recep Tayyip Erdogan's party, the ruling Justice and Development Party, the AKP, has lost control of the capital, Ankara. The opposition is also leading in the mayor's race in Istanbul, according to preliminary election results. The BBC's Mark Lowen is in Istanbul. He says it's a major setback for Turkey's President Erdogan.
This was his backyard. It was the city he ran as mayor before he was propelled to power as prime minister in 2003. And to lose Istanbul, Ankara and other big cities is a significant blow to the president. Now, I have to say that the governing party has not yet conceded here in Istanbul or elsewhere. They are waiting for the official results to come within 3 days. But it seems like really President Erdogan's conservative, pious support base has turned against him amidst a worsening economic crisis here.
Now, as part of the AKP alleges invalid votes and irregularities in most of the 12,000-plus polling stations in Ankara, does that mean Erdogan will be contesting the results there? And how's that going to play out?
They'll be challenging the results, but it's very unlikely to be reversed because the margin of victory in Ankara is pretty large. In Istanbul, it's just a whisker. But if there are irregular or invalid ballots, they are not all going to go to the governing party to overturn the result. But it seems increasingly likely that this is now a done deal. And in fact, the candidate for the opposition, Ekrem İmamoğlu, has actually changed his Twitter handle to say Istanbul mayor. So as far as they're concerned, it's over.
Mark, these are local elections in Turkey, not national ones. Why are they so significant? And what does it actually mean for Erdogan himself?
they're so significant because they had become, in effect, a referendum on President Erdogan. He made this intensely personal. He was at about 100 rallies. And this is a country where 90% of the media is pro-government, so it's pretty astonishing that they have suffered such a big blow. It is very significant because local elections are where you build patronage and support at grassroots level to then go on to a national support base. And really, this is, I think, a change in what the image President Erdogan has had over the last 16 years as someone who was invincible, seemingly, towering over a seemingly fractured opposition. Well, they have managed to coalesce around single candidates, and they have shown that Turkey's most powerful and polarizing president for decades can indeed be beaten.
What has President Erdogan said about the results himself? Anything?
He spoke to his supporters last night in Ankara, a typical balcony speech, as he calls it, where he stands at his party headquarters, towering over his adoring fans. And I have to say, there was none of the kind of typically combative triumphalism that we usually hear from him. He threatened during the campaign to deal an Ottoman slap to his opponents. He played in several election rallies the video of the New Zealand terror attack from a couple of weeks ago to galvanize his Muslim support base. So there was none of that kind of tone. It was much more chastened. It was much more kind of real. He said, "If there are shortcomings, we will address them."
One last thing, Mark. Much of the media, as you say, is state controlled there, so they're telling their side of the story. When you scan independent media in Turkey and social media platforms, what is the public analysis of what happened in this election?
As ever in this country, Marco, it's just so incredibly polarized, so much so that actually this morning in Istanbul, huge billboards had been erected saying, Teşekkürler Istanbul, thank you Istanbul, victory billboards by the government because they were so sure of victory and they wanted to sort of almost impose that as a fait accompli against the opposition. Then when it became clear they hadn't won, those billboards were taken down. But just looking at those billboards this morning, it really was like a parallel reality here. And, you know, never the twain shall meet, as they say. You can't. It's so hard to debate with one from one side to the other. The cleavage runs so deep, and you know the front pages of all the pro-government media were congratulating President Erdogan on yet another historic victory. No mention of the fact that it looks like they've lost major cities. Information here is weaponized, and it's kind of used as a tool by both sides, and that is the state of modern Turkey.
We will wait for the final vote count, but this seems really big. The BBC's Mark Lowen in Istanbul. Thanks very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Even today, there are some sites and events from the Holocaust that are little known. In Belarus, the story of the Jewish ghetto in the city of Brest and the mass killings there under Nazi occupation are not widely understood, even in Belarus itself. Now a vast grave has been discovered there during construction work, and the city's Jewish community wants the horrors of the early 1940s to be commemorated properly for the first time. My BBC colleague Sarah Rainsford reports from Brest in Belarus, close to the Polish border.
Slowly, gently even, a young soldier removes the dirt of decades from human bones lodged in the ground in front of him. He's unearthing a little-known chapter of the Holocaust in western Belarus. There are women and children here, he tells me, placing a teenager's skull in a plastic crate. The mass grave was discovered during construction work on a block of flats, and Dmitry says his team have already recovered the remains of more than 1,000 people killed because they were Jews.
There are clear bullet holes in the skulls. People were shot in the back of the head, and all the bodies were lying face down. The Nazis dug ditches, and people were shot, then fell. Shot, then fell.
Before World War II, almost half the population of Brest were Jews. Several thousand were executed almost immediately after the German invasion. The rest were herded into a ghetto behind barbed wire until the order came to wipe them out. At his kitchen table, Mikhail Kaplan shows me photographs of some of his family who were killed. He'll never know exactly where they were buried. Mikhail's parents only survived because they were out of town when the war began.
My father never spoke about what happened. It caused him so much pain. But my grandmother cried all the time, remembering Lisa, Lizochka. When they returned, the city was half empty. All their friends had gone.
And yet, at the time, Mikhail says, the massacre wasn't marked.
Everyone knew what had happened, but officially, no one spoke of it. The Germans destroyed us, deliberately. The Soviets just stayed silent about us.
Even now, the only Holocaust museum in Brest is underground. A basement room curated and run by the small Jewish community that settled here after the war. But the events it catalogues are immense. Efim shows me a register of the ghetto kept by the Germans in 1942. One day in October, it records almost 18,000 Jews. The next day, that number has been scratched out. Efim is trying to recover that hidden history. But in Belarus, he says, the fate of the Jews was always merged with the country's overall catastrophic losses under Nazi occupation.
You know, in Soviet times, it was shameful to say you were Jewish and you didn't talk about the Holocaust. War memorials here were dedicated to Soviet citizens, but that was very offensive because the Jews were not killed for resisting the Nazis. They were killed because they were Jews.
Bone by bone, that history is being uncovered now. As work at the gravesite wraps up for another evening, the soldiers gather giant plastic sacks. They tell me it's what they've collected here in just a couple of days. And they expect to unearth a lot more.
Egyptian writer Ala Alaswani made his mark with his best-selling novel, The Yacoubian Building. But now he's gained attention for something else. Egypt's military is suing him for insulting the country's president. Ala Alaswani is at his home in New York City. Why are you getting sued? What did you write that angered authorities in Cairo?
Well, they have been angry with me now for 5 years, you know. The first week Mr. Sisi became the president, I was banned from any TV appearance, and then I was banned from writing in the Egyptian newspapers. So it's not new, but this is a kind of escalation. They say that I insulted the president Sisi and I insulted the state institutions. These kind of accusations don't mean anything legally, but they are used over and over to punish anybody who criticizes the president.
5 years now you've had hassles with the government of Sisi in Cairo. 5 years takes us back to the military coup in 2013. I want to go back before that. Your own background, you grew up in Egypt in the 70s. Your dad was a writer, and you became a dentist and part-time writer until your book, The Yacoubian Building, took off in 2002, became an international bestseller. Remind us what that book was about and how it transformed your life.
It was a phenomenon. I mean, translated to 37 languages, millions of copies sold. So Yacoubian Building is a real building, still exists downtown Cairo. And my characters are the tenants inside the building.
A real mixed kind of colorful bag of characters.
Absolutely, and it reflected all the social and political problems by that time. But it's basically fiction.
I mean, I imagine like the characters in the Yacoubian Building could have been some of the people in the streets of Cairo during the Arab Spring, protests that you took part in. I know a lot of people hope those protests would be a turning point for Egypt. What were your hopes when you were demonstrating?
Of course, we wanted a democratic, secular state, and we fought for that. And unfortunately, Egypt has been cornered between, this is my opinion, between two fascist groups. I mean, the military and the Islamists. And they have made many times an alliance against the revolution, against the democratic force. But I have been against, because I'm defending the democracy, so I have been against the regime for years and years, for decades. So I have been against Mubarak and then against the military council and then against the Muslim Brothers and against the Sisi. And I must tell you that the Sisi is the worst as far as human rights may be concerned.
So after Sisi came to power in 2013, did you continue to write critically of the government?
Yes, I wrote, for example, the elections through which Sisi arrived to power were not free elections, were not fair elections. So I was banned. I was banned.
How did you end up in New York?
The American universities, they always have a place for a writer in residence. And I had invitations long time ago, but I didn't find any reason to leave Egypt. So after being banned from everything, you know, I began to accept the invitations. But every time I got back to Egypt, they gave me a very hard time in the airport. Every time detained for 2 hours, and it was terrible. But I insisted to get back like 2 or 3 months and then back to America.
I'm curious, if you were back home, do you think you would be in jail instead of being sued?
Well, I mean, the problem is that the regime now is worse than ever, than ever, you know. The regime has everything in Egypt, you know, has the army, has the police, has the all the media, are TV channels, newspapers, under control. Despite all this, I find this very interesting. I believe that the generals who are ruling don't feel secure because they never expected the revolution, and then the revolution happened. So they act as a wounded tiger. The wounded tiger is very dangerous. A wounded tiger is attacking everybody. And I believe that this is the way the regime is acting now in Egypt.
So what's next for this lawsuit? I mean, what do you have to do now in this matter?
A military case in Egypt is totally decided by the president. Even if I send my lawyer, it's totally useless to participate to something like this, because by the end, the president will decide the sentence. You see my point?
Yeah. Ala Alaswani, the best-selling Egyptian novelist, is being sued by the Egyptian government. He's been speaking with us from his current home in New York City. Thank you very much. It was a great honor.
Thank you. Thank you. Honor is mine.
Finally, this April 1st, in this era of fake news, it's a challenge to keep things real sometimes. And on April Fool's Day, the line between fake and fun is even more maddening. So here's a roundup of stories that could be true or not, prepared by our producer, Patty Daniels.
Hey, Marco. Okay, so we have kept you in a game show isolation booth to prepare this April Fool's Day news quiz. Are you ready?
Yeah, well, last time I looked at Twitter was 3 hours ago, so I am so out of it.
Okay, we're going to start with Google, which has taken artificial intelligence into the greenhouse to develop Google Tulip. Advancing the idea that plants respond to stimuli, Google Tulip can translate the impulses of flowers into dozens of human languages.
That's false.
Okay, Google, talk to my tulip. What do you want?
Water, please.
All right.
So actually, that is false, of course. Thank you very much. To high production values, there is no Google tulip. Coming up, we go to France. Police canine units in France are getting competition from rabbits.
Marinette, les lapins. Les lapins ont d'excellentes qualités, qu'elles soient olfactives.
So that's a French police officer telling us that rabbits have excellent agility, hearing, and smell 30 times better than dogs. Are rabbits being recruited into the French police force?
I don't know where you would have gotten that tape otherwise, unless the French themselves are doing their poisson d'avril. So I'm going to say that's true.
It is false. The French are in on the joke.
They did go for it. All right.
Okay, last one up. A singing nun will return to Italian television in yet another talent contest. Sister Christina Scuccia lives in a convent in Milan, but she became famous a few years ago on Italy's version of The Voice. And since then, she did a video remake of Madonna's Like a Virgin. True or April Fool's?
I want it to be true. I'm going to say it's true.
Let's listen.
Never heard it this slow.
So I thought this was like super funny and kitschy, and then I watched the video and it's actually really beautiful and moody.
Thank you very much, Sister Christina, and thank you, Patty Daniels.
Yes. Marco, congratulations, and as always, thank you for paying attention to the real news of the world.
Thank you for stumping this chump, Patty. Appreciate it.
Happy April Fools.
This is a wrap, and that's no kidding. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow. Like
like a friend.